away from her, you... This thing just won't leave. All I want to do is kick back and enjoy the DirecTV we just hooked up. I mean, I just got the best TV package in the universe for free. This is going to feel almost as good as when I got rid of cable.
Get our best TV package free for 4 months.
Although edited for television, tonight's thriller contains scenes of suspense and violence which may be unsuitable for young viewers. Parental discretion is advised.
Dark Horse Comics number 3 was released on October the 27th, 1992, according to Mike's Amazing World of Comics. Picking up from the Renegade two-parter, the initial RoboCop and Time Cop serials were still running. Gary Gianni's strip Indiana Jones and the Shrine of the Sea Devil began. Also starting this issue was the cover-featured Alien's Tale horror show. It was written by Sarah Byam, best known for the Dark Horse miniseries Billy 99 with the late Tim Sale, as well as the first comic series with Black Canary as the titular star. David Roach is an extraordinarily detailed but not remotely prolific illustrator, best known for his work on 2000 AD, and by me specifically for Cy Judge Anderson Ingram's. At his peak, he could rival Boland, but never attained his level of fame, switching to inking other artists and merchandising work. More recently, he's been involved with editing and writing for Comic Book Artist Magazine, special editions for Dynamite Entertainment, and the Superhero Book. The gist of the story is that when Earth fell to alien infestation, it was written off by an entertainment complex on the moon called Luna City. Get it? For the most part, it seems to be a film studio that was converted into a refuge, although media still dominates there. Mental health is an issue after the significant traumas brought on by the aliens. A new form of VR is under development, but a subset of the volunteers for the program are driven insane by the process. There's a pipeline to an unethical medical director modeled after Patrick McNee, who runs the local mental asylum. It's inferred that he takes liberties with his patients, and also records their dreams for use in the VR program. Unfortunately, everybody dreams of aliens, which isn't very useful as escapist entertainment. Eventually, some of the VR victims end up strengthened by the process and take revenge on the chief psychiatrist. They kidnap him and imprison him with what may or may not be an actual xenomorph egg. I did not enjoy this thing that I feel barely qualifies as a story. It reads like someone wrote a script based on already illustrated pages and then tried to translate that script to a foreign language with Google. Or maybe the script was for a miniseries, but they only drew a third of it and hope nobody would notice if they serialized the finished bits. There's a long sequence in the middle where nominal protagonist Robin with a Y is shown wearing xenomorph carapace as an armor. She then infiltrates hives to plant bombs in the queen's nest before doffing the armor to run away to attract drones out of the nest. I believe this is a VR sequence or a delusion, but even with dream logic, why would you want to imperil yourself to lead the aliens away from the danger you're placing them in? What about the evil psychiatrist who initially suggested to be housing the VR casualties to cover the cost of supplying free mental health services to the public, but later seems to be a well-connected institution profiting off of the patients? But also it seems like the doctor is conducting his own experiments, but to what end is never explained. I guess Robin, fashioning herself as a capable heroine, is what allows her and others to overcome the VR damage. But the scenarios depicted don't make that real for the reader, and why only target the psychiatrist? There's a doctor actually involved with the development of the VR, and the reckless studio executive that walk away scot-free. As best I can tell, Robin's father just paid for a squad of science mercenaries to mentally and physically liberate his daughter, then take revenge on the doctor he'd blamed for his daughter's vegetative state. But how do they magic her out of that state? And do they ever address the system that creates the VR casualties in the first place? Anyway, this story is a disjointed mess, the characters are vague ciphers, and the whole thing is more frustrating than anything else. Over the run of Horror Show, continuing for two more issues of Dark Horse Comics, it was joined by the Predator strip Blood Feud and non-starter Comics Greatest World property Mad Dogs. Aliens also got another cover, this one for number 5 and drawn by Dave Dorman. Aliens left the book for 5 issues before returning with an Arthur Adams Godzilla cover featuring small head profiles of Predator, James Bond, and a xenomorph. The alien representation is a quick 4-pager.
Taste from Dark Horse Comics number 11 by Edward Martin III and Mark A. Nelson. Rows of leathery eggs stand waiting in the dark, moist interior of some unknown spaceship. As we get an x-ray view of the long, finger-like appendages inside one ovoid, the narration muses on the nature of danger, on how, while all fear it, it is ultimately necessary for our lives. Without the excitement of danger, life becomes unbearably dull. But the inevitable question is, how much danger to risk? The egg's flaps peel open, pale legs reaching up through the viscous ichor, the strong, spring-like tail coiled hidden beneath. As the narration continues, that while for some people the usual risks of the everyday are enough of a thrill, others choose the safety of home, not daring to cross their own threshold. Conversely, some live for the thrill of an adrenaline rush, the pallid, insectoid form of the facehugger flies through the air, while others are epicures of peril, satisfied only with rare delicacies of jeopardy. Massive, scaly fingers, each tipped with a large black talon, grip the empty egg, and our view zooms out, twisting to reveal that the ovomorph has been upended into a frying pan, the parasite inside smashed down with a large spatula. A giant, lizard-like extraterrestrial, dressed in the universal dingy apron of a diner cook, is preparing a batch of fried facehuggers. After all, one's acceptable level of danger is only a matter of taste. Okay, fun little short story. Definitely a hilarious twist with that tonal 180 at the end there. And even though it's mostly set up for the gag, it does pose an interesting question about how much danger are you willing to accept. I know when I was a kid, I was terrified of roller coasters, which I'm a bit better with now. Although, on the other hand, I started skiing in my early teens, and as soon as I hit 30, it was like a switch went off in my head, and all of a sudden I'd get up to the top of the hill and go, oh my goodness, what am I doing up here? This is absolutely crazy. Turns out acceptable levels of danger aren't just subjective from person to person, but can vary throughout your life. So yeah, great little, I wouldn't say story, more just vignette, or even just extended newspaper strip joke. But, well, I don't remember if Frank has people give reviews, but if he does, I'm gonna go with 4 out of 5 on this one.
Yes, Angela, we do allow for critical reviews here. For instance, since this gag was already played in the Dark Horse Presents 5th Anniversary Special, I didn't have much use for it. Simon Bisley's outrageous art better suits comedy, so it feels like Nelson's considerable talent was wasted here. Another thing we like on the show is to hear about your personal history with the Aliens franchise, so hopefully next time we'll get to spend a little more time with Angela on that front. As for instance, we've had Ryan Daly on enough times that he had an anecdote to spare, and it seems like it fits best here in the Omnibus.
I have never been much of a gamer. I should amend that and say, like, you know, we had a video game console when I was growing up. We had a Nintendo, and I played them, then a Super Nintendo. And the problem for me is, once I got into a game, I became kind of, like, obsessive over it, really got into that game and had to play it a lot. Maybe I just had a sense about myself where I was like, I probably shouldn't do this very often because I'll become, like, addicted to gaming if I really got into that. And that's, like, with video gaming. There were franchises and IP and things that kind of, like, fascinated me that I tried to get into, like with role-playing and everything, but it was more reading the concepts and the fiction around it and getting into things. There was a role-playing game called The Mute Chronicles and had a card game called Doom Trooper that I collected some of these things. I never played the game. I never played the role-playing game. My friends and I, we never sat down and made characters. I got this stuff almost as reference material for the stories that I was writing on my own, in my own little kind of headcanon head adventures, but I never played those games. In high school, this would have been 97 or 98. My friend Jay T and I, he was one of my friends who collected comics with me. We went to, I mentioned this in a previous episode, Northern Lights Bookstore, and we see at the shelf as we're getting ready to check out Aliens Predator, the customizable card game. It was a game for either 2 to 3 players. It was one of those deck building games like Magic or all these other types of games we play where you're kind of creating like the best possible card combination to play against someone else in combat. And it allowed you to play either as the aliens, the Colonial Marines, or the Predator. Each faction, depending on who you're playing, had different assets, different types of characters, different types of weaponry, except for the aliens, but they had other things. And it was kind of a game of skill and combat or stealth and rescue or retrieval or spreading. Lots of different options. And we saw these and we're like, whoa, really cool. And we looked, and the thing about the way the game was set up was there was a starter pack for each faction. And the Colonial Marines, it was a green starter pack that came with 60 cards, I think, that allowed you to build a deck all about the Colonial Marines. And the aliens was dark blue and the Predator was dark red, and they were like 6, and then there were just the assembled booster packs, like card packs of 10 that could be for anybody. JT and I looked and we kind of like had like a really quick conversation. We decided we're gonna get this game, we're gonna try it out. And we had a third friend who was not at the store with us, but JT got the Colonial Marines, I got the aliens, and then we went home, we called up my friend Drew and said, hey, we've got to take you to this bookstore and you've got to get this card game with us and you've got to be the Predator. He was like, okay. We talked him into buying this pack sight unseen. And then that night, this was like a weekend night or something, they came over and we were downstairs and my basement had a pool table that never got used for that purpose. And we spread these cards out and each picked the faction that we had this affinity for. For the Marines, the goal was, each part of the game, you started off with a certain number of cards in deck and could have like certain characters and then certain locations. And throughout the game, you kind of build the locations and add on until you create this complex that where they're all connected and then your characters can interact. Usually particularly violently, as the case would be. For the Marines, I think you started off with four characters. As the game went on, as the game, you build up their armor. So they start off with pulse rifles. You can give them flamethrowers. You can give them smart guns. You can get, like, the automatic machine guns that are in Aliens, where they're sentries, where you can plant them in a location, and they'll wipe out anybody that walks in that room. And the goal is you're supposed to rescue these people from the space station that's been infected by the Aliens hive. The Predator, his goal is he's in his ship. He lands at the docking bay or something like that, the airlock, and he can be invisible, so he can move around unseen until he actually, like, encounters you, and he armors up the same way with the Marines. With the Aliens, I think you start off with a queen in the hive, and then I had two warriors or drones, I don't know what they were called, and the goal is I'm supposed to capture these people, like hostages or civilians, bring them to the hive. Once they're there for like two or three rounds, they become impregnated and they get chestburster and they turn into more warriors. So that's how I build up the number of Aliens I had. And now with weapons, the Marines and the Predators can use long range tactics or stealth tactics. The Aliens can't use long range, but they have other things. Like if the Marine shoots me and kills one of my warriors, I can play a card like Acid Splash, where the acid sprays and damages the setting around me. So they were, you know, as the nature would be, as you would assume, there are tactical advantages and disadvantages to each one of the troops. All of the story, I remember this being one of the most fun nights that we had, because I swear, I think we only played the game once. We got these packs, we spent the money to get these starter packs, and I think we only played it that first night because we spent so much time. The game is supposed to be like half an hour to 45 minutes, and I swear we played a 3-hour game that never really ended. It ended up being a stalemate. By the end of it, the guy, my JT, who was in charge of the Colonial Marines, I think two of his Marines were killed, one by my Aliens, one by the Predator. One of his Marines was like basically in a coma in the med lab and couldn't move, and he was down to just one Marine. The Predator had killed my Alien Queen and killed somebody else. And like basically the Predator's job is to go there, kill so many people, basically to collect their skulls as like collect trophies. And then he has to get back to his ship. The Predator can't win unless he gets back to his ship and evacuates. And he had killed my queen and wiped out my hive, so I couldn't win at that point. I had no way of spreading and creating more Aliens. But I had one warrior left, and I planted the warrior in the airlock between the Predator and his ship. So if he returned to his ship, he could have killed me. He still could have used like his shoulder cannon to blow my Alien away from a distance before I could even attack him. But I had the Acid Splash card in reserve, so once my Alien died, the Acid Splash would destroy the airlock, and he would not be able to get to his ship. And then both of us would have been dead, leaving just the lone one human Marine survivor trapped in the med lab. So because of that, he never went back to the airlock. We were just kind of like in this perpetual stalemate. So the three of us, none of us could win, but none of us could die. And we just kept on trying to psych each other out and do different tactics. And that was the way it took us like hours, like up to like, you know, high school kids, but like, you know, probably like we were like 16, something like that, and just playing this until midnight. And yeah, maybe we just kind of knew it was never going to get more fun than that. And we would never have a better outcome. The fact that none of us won, but none of us lost. So yeah, I don't think I collected any of the cards. I think they expanded on the card game because right around the same time as when Alien Resurrection came out. So I do think there might have been an expansion pack that included the space pirates that were introduced in that movie, like with Ron Perlman's character and those guys. Like you could do like a faction like that, or like the clone Ripley or something like that. You could be characters from the movie, but, or you could add them, or they gave your like the Marines more inspiration and stuff. But it was a really funny experience. That it just I always kind of think back of that as like one of my highlights from high school with, you know, my best friends playing this card game. And the only time we ever played, but it was like an Aliens versus Predator versus Colonial Marines game that we all basically ended up with a detente because we had mutually assured destruction. And I thought that was very fitting for those three, you know, what they called the deadliest of species. And continuing on this idea of not being much of a gamer, with Aliens being the exception, in college, maybe junior year, I lived alone my last 2 years in college. I had an apartment by myself, which is why I have such a winning personality. I wasn't much of a gamer, but just I found it and I was curious by it. The PC game, Aliens vs. Predator 2. And I had seen, probably my friend Drew had the first one, and we tried playing it, and I thought it was terrible. But the second one, it was a first-person shooter, and that kind of design for it, which I had some experience with because my freshman year, my roommate had the GoldenEye game for Nintendo 64, which we had tournaments in our room playing that with other friends. But this was a game, again, where you'd be three different groups. You'd be the alien, you could be the Colonial Marine, or you could be the Predator. And each one had its own story with like 7 to 10 levels, but the stories were like concurrent. They kind of crossed over at certain times. They were all the same general location on this planet. And I remember the aliens started off with, you know, you start off as a face hugger, as like the egg that's being transported falls off this thing. And the whole first level is you're just sneaking around ventilation shafts in the shadows, avoiding being seen, because if you get seen, you get blown away. And you just have to sneak away until you find one crew member sleeping in an office or something. And then you leave, press the jump key and you leap onto his face. And then the second level, you're just a chest burster. And it's the same thing, just a tiny little thing creeping around the shadows until you get to like these stables and you feast on, you know, some cattle or beef or something like that. And you grow full grown. I like to play the alien. Maybe that was just like the creature that I also like resonated with, in part because it was the simplest, because in terms of like the combat and tactics, it was just slash with your claws, punch, kick, or like shoot tail or something. Actually, if you lashed out with your tail, you could paralyze somebody and stun them. And if they were stunned, you could get up close to them with your jaws. And if like there was like a targeter in like in dead center, and if like you like the target was on their face, you saw like kind of like the outer jaws spread out, and the inner jaws gave you like the alien kiss where it shot out into their brains, and that gave you like extra scores, extra life. So as often as possible, if you could stealth somebody and sneak up and eat their brains or paralyze them and do that, like those were good tactics. So I just felt like I didn't have to be in control of as many buttons when I was playing as the alien. And then with the Marines and the Predator, it got more complicated because you could toggle between infrared vision or other kinds of vision, toggle different types of weapons, and are you invisible or are you hidden? But it was good. And I just like the production, the design of a game for the time. We're now talking about a game that's 20 years old. I just thought it was like really well done, you know, just playing that game with the lights off. It could be scary at times, you know, especially as playing the Marines or whatever, and you get that motion tracker going off. Yeah, it was just, these are the fun memories. And I kind of, these things live with me as elements of the Aliens franchise that exist beyond the media of the movies, as well as the fiction, the prose, and the comic book stories. That these are some of my favorite little avenues where the Aliens took me. And it's just because I don't play a lot of other like PC or computer games or customized hardens, but the Aliens seem to be the exception.
Aliens remain in the Dark Horse Comics rotation after Taste, but because that two-parter ties into a later tale, we'll skip ahead. A new cover-featured serial for The Mark began with number 14, but with the end of the Predator arc Bad Blood, Aliens returned with Dark Horse Comics number 15. Released November 30th, 1993, the issue competed with two editions of the Aliens magazine, the third issues of Deadliest of the Species and Labyrinth, plus a Salvation one-shot. It's no wonder they gave the cover to The Thing from Another World. The 16-page, two-part Cargo was by Dan Jolly, John Nadal, and Terry Pallett. Jolly is best known as the co-creator of the Jason Rush Firestorm, as well as the creator-owned Bloodhound, and has worked with Tony Harris on titles like Obergeist. Nadal penciled much of the Star Wars X-Wing Rogue Squadron series, as well as an arc for the 1998 Star Wars ongoing series set in the prequel period. Pallett inked much of the run of Malibu Comics' Star Trek Deep Space Nine adaptation, then followed Gordon Purcell to DC's Next Generation series, and has in recent years done work for Marvel Comics. As one might expect from a 16-page two-parter, the simple premise is clearly established. Despite the outlawing of XenoZip, there's still illicit demand for the product, and Xenomorph Oreo jelly in general. One smuggler is wrapping up his career running the stuff, but in order to walk away clean, he's turned informant on the kingpin he's been running for. On the prototypical one last job, the kingpin is willing to sacrifice a very large vessel to trap the smuggler aboard with an alien drone. Figuring the beast to be hungry, the smuggler lures it into a trap by leaving a trail of his own blood. Later, he mails a facehugger to the kingpin as his own revenge. It's an okay story as long as you don't spend a second thinking about the details. A lot of effort, expense, and logistical difficulty goes into these elaborate circumstances where simple cartel shit would have sufficed. Hell, wouldn't the smuggler be screwing up his own deal with the feds to hit the kingpin in a way that he would surely be prepared for anyway? It's a dumb trifle, like most of these stories. For Dark Horse Comics number 17, The Thing was dropped in favor of the cover-featured Star Wars droids. The Predator serial The Hunted City was ongoing. Released January 25th, 1994, Aliens did not need the cover when it was competing with the issues of its own magazine, Deadliest of the Species, Colonial Marines, Labyrinth, and the debut of Music of the Spears. The second issue did take the cover spot on a month when only two of those Aliens books were released. Simply titled Alien, the 24-page three-parter was by John Arcudi and Paul Mendoza. Both will return for future Alien stories. I'll read copy on those stories, beginning with issue 16, Alien, a new Alien story featuring fabulous artwork by Paul Mendoza and a terrifying script by the unequaled John Arcudi. Meet Swarm, who isn't yet a man to his tribe, but is the only living soul who has seen the Night Reaper, a horrifying demon that feeds on his people at night and disappears by morning.
Okay, all right. So tell me what you thought about the Alien story.
Well, I thought it was a bunch of goofus nonsense. I mean, you never figure out who it is in the suit. Mm-hmm. You never figure out, was that the ship that crashed, you know?
Well, what's the story?
The story is that these aliens are being attacked by the alien. They're aliens I'd never heard of, and they're attacked on this planet of theirs by the alien that they call, what was it, Night Stalker or something?
I think Night Reaper.
Yeah, okay, the Night Reaper. It happens every time the men go out hunting like they're some kind of native in South America or in Africa or something. That's when it strikes. And of course, that's the first goofiest thing, because if Alien could take on a ship loaded with modern trained soldiers ready to fight it, you know, because you know the story.
Yeah.
It's not like you're reading it for the first time in 1965 or something. You've already seen, you know, I've got every movie they made, including the last ones, you know, where Alien is fighting, you know, the Schwarzenegger. I can't even think of it. I can't think of...
Oh, Predator.
Predator, yeah. The Alien versus Predator. Mm-hmm. Which I enjoyed the movie, but I thought that was pretty goofy. Mm-hmm. I own all those movies. So here I'm reading this comic book version. And of course, you know, it's like you're always going on and other people that dig comic books are looking at the art. The art sucked.
I like the art.
You do?
Yeah. What didn't you like about the artwork?
As comic books go, I guess you'd call it comic book impressionism. Everything's blurry, nothing's sharp. The colors were kind of dull. And the aliens changed color from kind of a orange or burnt color to green. Something else that had absolutely no explanation for. Why did they suddenly change color? Were they chameleons? And the story was simple. I mean, it was super simple.
Well, I mean, you started out telling what the story was, but you didn't finish.
Okay, so they decide they're going to go after the alien, and they come across the ship. And, you know, right off, you see the, what was it, in 3, where they discover the ship with the body in it?
Well, it happens throughout the alien stuff, so.
Well, but there was just one where they go to the planet and they discover the hulk of the ship, and it's got, and I guess it was the alien ship.
First one, I believe, yeah.
Yeah, because that's where they got the egg from, or that's where he, okay, yeah, maybe it was. Anyway, it was the same thing. You know, here's this crashed alien craft, the exoskeleton of the giant queen laying out, you know, like Buddha. Then, to them, this creature comes up, which is all obviously supposed to be, you know, from the movies, somebody from Earth.
My recollection, you got the one, like, kid that's actually been keeping an eye on the alien. He was watching the alien come into the village, kill the women and children, and go back out at the village again. And he wants to go on the hunt with the older ones who had kids killed before. This kid's never done any of that stuff. And so he's wanting to prove himself. And because a lot of these guys are like, look, there aren't a lot of us, and we're the only thing that keeps this village alive, because we're the hunters. If we stop hunting, then the whole village dies from starvation. So they're like, okay, we're going to take this kid with us. And they go and they track the alien to kill it. They finally catch, or it actually ambushes them. And when they try to fight it, not only does it kill the lot of them, or a lot of them, but also when they do manage to stab it with their spears, because they're an atavistic alien race, the spears aren't very good when you've got alien blood that's acidic. So they're scarred, and the leader of the group is blinded and loses a limb. And so the younger kid's trying to find shelter for the chief, and they end up finding the spaceship they crashed that brought the alien to that planet in the first place. And they also run across essentially an astronaut.
Right, and he renders aid. Or she, you never...
Yeah, they're never clear about that. It's ambiguous, yeah.
You know, as I was going through it, I kept looking for Sigourney Weaver, you know. Uh-huh. Anyway, in the end, the astronaut kills the alien.
With a gunshot, one rifle shot.
Right.
And he's already wounded, but still, usually they don't die that quick.
Right. Well, and that was the other thing. You know, it was too damn easy.
Uh-huh.
And then he's killed because tribal member wants to be king shit of the tribe, and he's afraid his mojo is stolen by this cat and the, you know, this strange creature.
Right. Stabs him from behind with a spear.
Right, you know, and kills it. So it was kind of like a drop-off joke or something, you know. Mm-hmm. They go through this whole thing, and then in the end, it's greed that kill him. Mm-hmm. I just didn't really, I mean, it might be a great lesson for a 10-year-old, but...
Well, it's a comic book, so maybe it is geared for a 10-year-old.
Well, I've looked at some of your comic books, and any 10-year-old, he's going to be pretty twisted by the time he gets cured.
Proof in the flesh. But yeah, I mean, the big thing was that already this kid hadn't proven himself yet, and his big proving thing was going to be killing the alien. And not only did he not kill the alien, but he helped get most of the hunters killed. And he's got nothing to show for it. So he kills the astronaut, and he tries to cut the head off the alien to show the tribe that A, the alien's dead, and B, that he's the one who killed it. But when he tries to cut the head off, of course, his knife melts from the alien blood. So ultimately, he shows up in the village with the helmet of the astronaut, because they don't know the difference anyway. Plus, he's got the hand cannon. Not even the hand cannon. That was a full-on rifle. I'm pretty badass with that. So if you think about it, though, I think he probably saves the village because they lost so many of their hunters that they get able to hunt with that rifle, even if it's got limited shots. That's probably going to tie them over for at least a little while. So.
Well, you have thoroughly thought it out much further than I have.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like when I went to see Alien.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about that too. Like, so did you watch commercials and you actually went to the movie theater and saw the movies that back in 79?
Yeah, didn't you come with us?
Hell no.
Oh.
I'm pretty sure
you, well, I think you went to at least one of the Alien movies with us.
I don't think I ever
Maybe
saw
Maybe it was three or something.
No, I don't think I ever saw any Aliens with y'all. I know I saw Aliens with my stepfather, and I saw Alien 3, I think, with my mother, and I saw Alien 4 alone, and I saw the last two ones, the Prometheus and the Covenant, with my girl, and then I just plain didn't see. Oh, and I saw the Aliens vs. Predator, the first one, with Fix-It and Pussycat, and I think Mac might have been there too.
Well,
I don't think I've ever seen an Alien movie with you.
Well, I know that.
But you saw it back in 79.
I saw it back in 79.
Do you remember?
And I saw it at the Windsor Theater with the big 70 millimeter screen. Mm-hmm. The reason why I went to the movie really was because of Veronica Cartwright. Mm-hmm. When I was a kid and lost in Space's zone. You know, and I think I'm like a year older than Mooney is. Lost in Space was one of my big shows.
Danger, Will Robinson.
Yeah, and...
Dr. Smith, was it?
Yeah, Dr. Smith was on...
Every now and again I'd catch it. I think it was late night on 20 back in the 80s, but not enough to have a strong sense of it.
Okay, well, the older sister, I was real attracted to her even as a 10-year-old, yeah. You know, or 11, however old I was. I can't remember. But I also thought that Veronica was kind of cute. So
and which one's Veronica?
She
the
was
younger sister?
She was the middle sister. Yeah,
okay.
The younger sister.
Because
there were two sisters.
Robinson. Okay, there's an older sister and a younger sister. Like I remember I remember there being an older sister.
Yeah.
And the boy. I didn't remember.
Yeah, the older sister. She had this you know budding romance all through the show with the pilot.
Yeah.
It was the pilot and the two doctors, which were the parents.
Yeah.
And you know she was hot. Mm-hmm. And I can't even remember her name.
I remember the older sister being a crush object
but
for a lot of
Veronica
guys.
Veronica Cartwright was on TV in a lot of shows, mm-hmm. 60s and the 70s. But it'd been a while since I had seen her. She was on this other sci-fi thing that was on like 74, 75. I can't remember the name of it either. Been a while since I had seen her. And of course, she definitely looked different. And of course, if you look at pictures of her, later in the 80s, it didn't even look like the same person. I mean, she changed so much.
Oh, yeah.
I've never seen somebody change.
Well, she was in Witch of Eastwick, right? Wasn't she like the scold in Witch of Eastwick?
Yeah, I think
that
so.
Keeps getting punished with dark magic spells?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
Anyway, well, that was the main reason I went. Sigourney Weaver...
Wasn't a thing then.
Wasn't a thing for me.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Did you ever get into her?
But, well, you know, as a badass, I did.
Yeah.
I think the only time that I could see her in a sexual context is like when she did Ghostbusters. And I think it was in the third movie. It was Cynthia Dale. She ain't much to look at today. But back then, dressed as a soldier, you know, in tank top and stuff. Sigourney Weaver, as far as I was concerned, didn't have nothing on her. But Sigourney Weaver was the one that always come out on top. And she...
Well, I think she's a really good heroine. And obviously in the first movie, when she's running around in just the little skimpy panties, I'm going to take notice of that. But there is a cerebral quality to her. I would say almost like an asexual quality. She doesn't put out that vibe.
That's right.
And so it's like I don't tend to think of her in those terms unless she's in a panty and bra.
Right.
And she is dolled up more for the Ghostbusters movies. But
well, guess, and that was real female stuff. Yeah. I mean, she was dressed really female, and she was the one that was in danger. You know, all that works on you. Guys love that crap. You know I do, to be the protector. You know, in a lot of these movies, it's going to be the female part. I'm looking at the female, you know. And what the guy's doing is cool because he's usually protecting the female or the kid or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. But think about it. There was no really female involvement in that story.
Yeah.
Zero zip. And even if it had, she'd been ugly. Man, everybody in there was ugly. I mean, the suit was kind of slick, but you don't know what was behind that helmet. There wasn't anything there to interest me. I read it because you said you wanted me to read it, and I knew you were going to ask me about the art, so I paid attention to that.
Yeah.
You know, but other than that.
Well, I kind of thought that I thought there was actually a slight biblical quality to it. And I think there's a little bit of at least a moral question posed by the story.
It's a simple moral story.
Yeah.
That's it. You know, there's an old saying about the Good Samaritan getting bit in the ass, you know. And that's what it was.
Well, there was a little bit of question, too, because the astronaut did give an injection, potentially a lethal injection, to the chieftain. Either to ease pain or just to put them out of the misery. And there was some question, I mean, the astronaut did feed the alien too, the alien boy, but there's some question about the intentions of the astronaut anyway. But obviously the tribesmen went to the worst place, not in part because they were motivated to do so for their own interest.
Well, okay, it's not that I didn't give it that much thought, because I did. I questioned what the astronaut was doing there.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think it's pretty straightforward. It's that the astronaut, that was their ship. The alien that was running around was produced from a fellow astronaut being exposed to a facehugger. The chest burster came out, developed into an adult alien, managed to get the ship crashed, and presumably this was the last survivor of that ship hunting the alien.
Okay, I didn't think of it that way because the queen that was laying on her back was...
There wasn't a queen, though.
If you look at that piece of art with the crashed spaceship,
okay,
the queen was right there.
I didn't see the queen.
I'll show you again later. But she's there stretched out just like she was in the movie.
Okay, I missed that. Yeah, I thought there was just one.
I assume that the astronaut was hunting the alien.
Yeah, that I agree with. Yeah.
Okay, but they don't give you anything. I can see why somebody might see what you saw, because they never show you the astronaut ship.
Well, that's what they find shelter in, is the crashed ship.
Yeah, but I didn't see that as the astronaut ship.
Okay.
Because the queen was so big. But then again, I've seen a lot of movies where they're hauling the whole, you know, in the original movie, they're supposed to be moving the egg or whatever. And the egg explodes and gets inside the guy or whatever.
Right.
That happens all the time in sci-fi. But then you also have sci-fi where they got a giant creature instead of killing it, like King Kong or the crocodile in Placid Lake, you know. They end up strapping it to a truck and trailer to try to make money off of it, which in and of itself is kind of a stupid moralistic story. And it's just that this story was a lot simpler.
Yeah.
We're sitting here as adults, you're middle-aged and I'm old. To try to dissect a comic book, it's hard to do that.
Sure. So that's why when you went and saw Alien, I know what your motivation was for seeing it. How did you react to the movie? Like, a lot of people were shocked by the chest burster, the initial chest burster, because they did not expect that to happen, for instance. How did you react when you saw the movie in the theaters?
I liked it. And you've got only so many movies that open new doors. And that was one of them. Alfred Hitchcock, okay? The shower scene. Mm-hmm. that opened new doors. That was really the scope of that movie. That's the one thing in that movie you never forget.
Yeah. Because I don't know if that was a fear that people had before that movie.
Nobody ever thought about that before that movie. It never would have dawned on them.
Yeah.
Okay. Then the next one I can think of was The Omen. Mm-hmm. You had all those different things that had never been seen before.
Well, what was it about The Omen that you found? Just the complete...
Wait a minute. Let me make...
Omen's one with Gregory Peck. And the little boy that's the son of the devil, essentially.
Yeah, okay. I'm confusing my movies. Just let me... shoot, I can't think of it. Hang on.
Who's in it?
You know, with the pea soup and the...
The Exorcist.
Yeah. Okay, in The Exorcist. Okay, I was in San Diego, California for The Exorcist. I was engaged to this really cute way. They had this movie theater in downtown. It was an older theater, kind of like an art deco, in downtown San Diego. So on weekend, that's the kind of thing I would do, you know, because people, you know, sailors, they don't have that much money. And you want to take the girl out and feed her and take her to a show and all. And it was cheap to take her to that movie. And The Exorcist was there. I had no real idea. That's the other thing when you're in the military. A lot of times you don't watch TV.
Yeah.
I mean, what TV you see, you know, I'd come back from the Vietnam War. And, you know, all the TV that we saw was stuff that was on film and it was broadcast, by the military.
Yeah.
You know, like if it was a football game, they'd be 2 weeks seeing that football game, you know. You have to work a lot of times 7 days out of the week. So all you got is your evenings free. And when I started dating her, I had an apartment. I wasn't living on base, which again, that's gonna eat up a bunch of what money I had. So we saw it in this thing. None of that stuff anybody had seen. You had a little girl cursing worse than most sailors. She was masturbating with a cross. Her head spun around. She spit up the contents of her stomach.
Forced her mother's head into her crotch.
All of that
heat
stuff.
On the floor.
You have no idea the wave. Only somebody that lived back then can tell you the wave of that.
Yeah.
I mean, it changed movies forever. All you got to do is look at movies prior to that and look at movies after. It changed movies forever. It's like there are no more boundaries. That was another one. And then, of course, Alien was another one with the thing coming up out of his chest. The same thing was done in that other horror movie where the kids at a camp or whatever lays down on the bed and the machete comes up through them.
I want to say it's one of the Friday the 13th.
Yeah, I think it was. Yeah. Maybe the first one. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Wasn't Kevin Bacon, was it? Getting the skewer?
I just remember the machete.
Okay.
What was the other one? In fact, I think they just... Hellraiser. Okay. I saw Hellraiser at the drive-in theater in Beeville, Texas. And let me tell you, you could hear the whole town gasp. Nobody had ever seen anything like that. Another movie like that, it's called They Shoot Horses, Don't They? There's a scene in the parking lot where she actually sticks the guy's tallywhacker in her, you know? Mm-hmm. Jane Fonda or no Jane Fonda, nobody had ever seen that in a dead gum movie.
Yeah.
You know? Those movies are what change what we watch forever. And Alien had that.
Yeah. And was it mostly the chest bursting sequence or just the whole...
All of it. But you had never seen a female badass like Sigourney Weaver in any movie before that. You can even look at the black exploitation films. They were bad. Don't get me wrong. Foxy Brown and
Coffee,
all of those were bad movies, okay? And they shocked people not just from the race point of view. They shock people because here you have something other than white who is sexy, confident, and will kick your ass. All of that changes. But Sigourney Weaver came out and tore the alien up. She was the hero. That really had never been seen before. I mean, I kind of loved it when she was in the robot thing fighting the robot. It was just cool. And the action was fast, too. It wasn't something slowed up so you would catch it.
Well, of course, that's more of the sequel, though. That's the one in 86.
Well, it still is the same point.
Well, the fact that you were able to do two movies that were revolutionary like that. That it wasn't just like one movie revolutionized in one way, and then the next one revolutionized
in another way. The point here, I guess, now is that the first one was revolutionary and it'll get you to go to the next one. Anyway, I saw the first three in movie theaters and I bought the DVDs ever since. I own them all and I still watch them just to see what would happen. But like Aliens versus Predators, I liked the movie okay. I mean, it was fine. But a lot of the stuff I'm always interested in, like the female presence and all that, just wasn't there. There is just a curiosity. Well, you know, it seems pretty plain to me who's going to win this to begin with.
Well, who's that?
Well, the way I saw it was that the alien had to win. Mm-hmm.
That's the way I see it personally, but not everybody agrees.
Well,
they're built for attrition. Even if you manage to kill one of them, the damage that one's going to do to your party, and there's always more than one of them.
Well, and there's also the point here that a human killed the alien. The human killed the predator. Predator ain't got a chance, man. He just don't.
The long shots and later Dark Horse comments letter columns are an odd thing. I scan through letters to get a sense of the reaction to the title, and specifically the alien stories, and the consensus largely amounts to meh. Lots of people calling for less licensed properties or pointing out the overall mediocrity. The placement of the letter column wasn't consistent, and there were several skipped issues, so I had to toss through the whole books to find the things. I have to say, the art and coloring seemed rather subpar. The title debuted at the tail end of the comics boom, but was mostly rooted in the bust. The talent pool was still stretched thin by the enormous production demand of the early 90s. Dark Horse was competing with Image, Valiant, Malibu, and countless others to staff their main titles. Dark Horse Comics was therefore having to make do with the guys not quite up to snuff for DC Showcase or Marvel Comics Presents. There's even letters that compare disparagingly against Dark Horse Presents. Certainly going by the quality of the alien stories presented here, the title feels less than essential. Basically in a market already oversaturated with aliens and predator content, this anthology feels very much like a cash grab made up of filler material. It's the farm team's farm team, really. And it's too bad they didn't try something like this later on when a lot of good people were struggling to find work. And it could have been a home to a property like Planet of the Apes that maybe can't quite carry rotating miniseries. The constant rotation of very short serials can't help sustain reader interest. Maybe do 12 chapters of Godzilla so all the licensed material isn't so ephemeral. There was clearly no strong editorial vision since they couldn't keep a team for much longer than the serials themselves. The fans seemed more enthused to see the comic's greatest world and other Dark Horse characters, but they couldn't carry the title on their own either. The whole Enterprise feels like compromised product, so it's no wonder it was short-lived. On Tumblr, Ainu Kruger liked The Post, William Gibson's Alien 3, The Emperor's Screenplay, 2018, Ray Punkorama reblogged The Post, Dark Horse Presents Aliens Tribes, 1992. As always, though, most of the action was on Twitter, coming from the 21st Century Boys, Amaran Media Genesis, Between the Pages blog, Billy Hines, CH, Chris Dunford, Chris Leiden, The Comic Crush, Dear Watchers, a Marvel What If podcast, Jaume Oliveira, Doc Strange, Dirk Ashton, Ed Moore, El Coleccionista de Comics, Ensign Lamar, The Revenger, Van Hole's podcast, History of Comics on Film, Illegal Machine, Iowa Joe Is, Jeffrey Brown, They Them, Just Cute Little Comics Guy, King Size Comics, Giant Size Fun Podcast, Mary Wilkins, Mike and Rihanna Mike, Mike and Send Aliens to Me, Pneumonic Boy, Phil Bowers, Rob Cave, Satin Tights, a Wonder Woman podcast, Siskoid, Superbound, Tomo Scori, and Wonder Woman Warrior for Peace podcast. Chris Dunford wrote, "This was such an awesome series, Frank Rocks," which started a thread of us making Sergeant Rock podcasts. If you can believe that. Billy Hines wrote, "Just listen to this. Frank, we thank you for your sacrifice. I remember reading issue one early in my U.S. comic collecting and not having a clue what was happening. I've forgotten it was Barreto on most of the art. Maybe officially the worst comic Schultz ever edited." Jeffrey Brown wrote, "Now this is interesting about Claremont's non-X-Men work on your podcast. I never knew he wrote Alien and Predator comics. I do have issues of his run on Wildcats with Jim Lee, but I never have read his novels. I really do enjoy Claremont's kinks, because of course. I have an ashcan of this comic in my collection. I always wondered what a Chris Claremont and Paul Smith Star Wars comic would look like back when Dark Horse had the rights for the comics. Also, but why wasn't there an Aliens versus Star Wars? I'm currently trying to get into it, so yeah, I am a newbie. But I already love Aliens versus Predator. Lamar the Revenger added, I had the first issue of Deadliest of the Species, but could never find any issues after that. I personally feel that there should be no Aliens Star Wars crossover. Aliens as a franchise would work better with Star Trek, though. I'm guessing the point is that since Fox had the rights to both Aliens and Star Wars, it would have been natural to have him face off. I think maybe Star Trek is malleable enough to better accommodate true horror, where with Star Wars, I don't know if you could go that deep into it. I think it would be dark fantasy at best. I do think a lightsaber would do a pretty decent job against an alien. Actually, it makes sense because the lightsaber is supposed to cauterize a wound right after it's made, so you probably wouldn't have to worry about that alien splash that Ryan was talking about earlier. Yeah, it would have been cool to see more interaction between the Fox franchises, but I think Lucasfilm was probably pretty protective of the Star Wars license. That's one of the reasons why Star Wars popped up so little in the Dark Horse comics that we're covering this episode. Meanwhile, if you look at some of the, I think particularly Next Gen did a few episodes that had kind of an Aliens vibe to it, just like Voyager did that one episode that had a strong Predator knockoff going on. So we've kind of seen it, but again, Star Trek, a very optimistic, hopeful universe. Not necessarily, not only conductive, but also they're so far in advance societally and technologically that I don't know that the xenomorphs would be as much of a problem for them. They actually follow protocol. You know, as you recall, if the crew of the Nostromo had followed protocol, that would have saved a lot of problems for the universe.
This has been the Roald Spine Podcast. All audio samples are believed covered under fair use laws. No copyright infringement is intended.
Coming in August, Dark Horse presents Aliens, Colonial Marines.